Hi there and welcome to Boris Effects' Flow Stay, Stories from the Creative Process. I'm your host Nick Haraz, and through one-on-one discussions with creative industry professionals, we aim to provide practical knowledge and insights, shedding light on the discipline, tools, and techniques that bring work to life. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Boris Effects, we're a leading developer of video editing, motion graphics, and visual effects plugins and software used in film, television, and video production. This week I'm joined by Andy Milkus, a freelance lead flame artist and visual effects supervisor with over 24 years experience. He's worked with major brands, agencies, networks, and studios, directing live action pieces for Target, CVS, Sesame Street, and more. He's also traveled the world as an on-set visual effects supervisor and loves helping clients bring their vision to life. We invite you to join our community by subscribing to the podcast and to continue the conversation on our YouTube page, where you'll find additional content, including episode highlights. Thank you for tuning into Boris Effects' Flow State. Let's explore the art and science behind the creative industry together. Hi, welcome to Boris Effects' Flow State, Stories from the Creative Process. Andy, thanks so much for joining me. For those of you who don't know about Andy, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I've been a flame artist since 1996 or 1997. My entire career has pretty much been in New York. And for the vast majority of that career, I've worked on commercials. I've worked at big companies. I've worked at small companies, like, you know, one person shops, and then you're part of a team of 10. I've worked on Super Bowl spots, large campaigns, documentaries, features, episodics, everything. Honestly, now that I'm 50 years old, and I'm proud to say that, and I can look back. For those of you who are listening to the audio at home, Nick's like jaw just dropped. He was like, "Oh my God!" Like, I don't know if he thought I was 70 or if he thought I was 30, but that's okay. You don't have to answer that, Nick. We'll leave it up to the imagination. But getting back to my story, looking back on it, this has been the best career choice I could have possibly made, because being a visual effects artist, in my case, being a flame artist, it speaks to both halves of my brain, the technical side that loves like problem solving and figuring things out. And when I was a kid, I was that kid who would take a toy apart just to see how it worked and then put it back together. And then the creative side that really came to me later in life. I didn't know that I had that in me. I love it. I absolutely love what I do. For me, the best part of the job is when I'm handed something and I don't know how I'm going to do it, and then figuring it out.
I want to dissect a couple things here. Number one, 35 was like the max I was going to go for in terms of the age.
Oh, you're too kind.
Say that. 1996, if I heard you correct, you've been a flame artist since. Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned like the wealth of projects that you've worked on. Has the industry changed a lot creatively in your mind?
I think I was really fortunate to get into this business when I did, because at the time, like, everything was new. So like when we first did a sky replacement, it was the first time you ever did a sky replacement. Anybody ever did a sky replacement, that kind of thing. The first morph you did, or the first photoreal CG thing you did. It was all new. Everything was new. The tools were new. I think I also benefited from coming into this at a period of time where, like, you didn't get instant gratification. Rendering took forever. Storage was very limited. The tool set was limited. You had to be able to see in your mind's eye what you wanted before you made it. You couldn't just click, 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 click and get a bunch of options. It trained me. It gave me discipline. How can I do this as quickly as possible, as convincingly as possible? And how do I look my client in the eye and make that kind of mental connection that you really have to, so that you're both on the same page, because you don't have all the time in the world. You have limited time, limited resources to kind of bring their vision to light. It's one of those things where you can say, like, everything's changed and absolutely nothing has changed. What I've seen happen over the last 25 plus years is the democratization of technology. The tech that we have, like that I have here in my little home office, is insane compared to what it was 5 years ago versus what it was 25 years ago. There's the constant downward pressure of time and budget. We want everything faster. We want everything cheaper. But okay, I mean, that's the human story. I mean, what has also happened, and this is what impacts my job creatively, is that our clients, whether it's someone at an ad agency, whether it's like a creative director at the company you're working at, or someone at an ad agency, or a director from a film or TV show, their career and their relationship with technology has gone on a different trajectory from mine. I always have to bear in mind that my client doesn't understand my process because it's gotten so much more complicated. We like to think that like, oh, visual effects is ubiquitous. Ha 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 ha. But it is for us. My client doesn't necessarily understand, nor should I expect them to understand what is involved in bringing the vision to life. It's kind of low rent for me to say that like my client hasn't been educated the way that like they were 25 years ago, but like who has other than me or people like me? What's changed the most over the last 25 years is that I need to use both sides of my brain. I need to be a much better communicator, a much better advocate, a much better storyteller to understand what it is they want, bring them on this creative journey that they're going to be super excited about. Yeah. But at the same time, work as efficiently as possible. Like there used to be three ways to do something. There's an infinite number of ways to do everything. And so you could go off into like a loop, you know, an infinite loop of getting nowhere because you have all these tools available.
There was a couple things that you said there that really resonated with me. One of those was your foundational background and how you were chatting about that you really had to have a strong vision in your head before you went out to try to create something because it took so long to render. When you see younger artists, flame artists or visual effects artists now where they're presented with these tools where they can see everything right away, do you think that they skip some of these foundations and this puts them at a disadvantage?
Well, at the risk of sounding like an old fuddy-duddy, which we now have established, I am at that threshold. The short answer is really yes. You have to understand why. And so I went to film school and I learned about framing and I learned about lensing and I learned about what a close-up means and why and that a dissolve denotes a passage of time and like pacing and storytelling. I learned about color and what these things mean. There are things that the viewer feels. They may not know why they feel it, but they feel it when they're presented with an image. And I think to be a truly good artist, you have to understand what the images that you're making, you know, the story that they tell. Otherwise, you're just like an arbiter of good taste. You're pushing buttons and going, oh, I think that's cool. And maybe it is. I mean, the Kardashians have proved that, like, you know, you can really just be, I don't even want to say good taste. What I stress with any young artist that I talk with or I've had the pleasure to work with or mentor is to really verse yourself in these foundational techniques of what we do. And as a visual effects artist, especially as a flame artist, you kind of cover all disciplines. We edit, we paint, we composite, we key, we roto, we light, and you have to be able to speak all those languages.
You touched upon the subject of client interactions. How do you balance your communication with the client? How do you balance not getting too much into the technical weeds with the client with describing parts of the process that are the most important to them and make them have confidence in you and your process?
That's a great question. I would say knowing your audience. I do have a little bit of a performance background and I like to think that I was ignored as a child, meaning like I was always like vying for attention. And honestly, in this capacity, it kind of served me well. Know your audience. Understand what your client is looking for. What's on their mind? Most of my career, and especially the foundational part of my career, was in advertising. And typically in advertising, your flame artist is the last stop before the spot goes on the air. So you're going to inherit everything, all the good and all the bad. And usually what happens is the client rolls into your flame suite. And you got to quickly be able to read that room and figure out why is everybody freaking out. 9 times out of 10, or maybe 10 times out of 10, at the beginning of what we're doing as a flame artist, they could care less about the process. They don't care. They have a vision and they want to see their vision come to light, or they have a concern, a problem, a challenge, and they want to know they're being heard. So the first thing that I always do is I always talk to the client, and more importantly, I listen. And I try to figure out what's not working. And usually you have a pile of feedback. And if you can aggregate that feedback, you can find the common thread. What I normally like to do is just begin working, begin solving their problems, making things more readable, making the sky more blue, adding a little bit more life to the scene, making it feel a little bit happier. And when I feel like something might be taking too long, or when I feel like they might be thinking, why is it taking so long? That's usually when I'll change the output of the flame screen so they can see the flow graph of the nodes. And typically the conversation is like, they're like, wow, like I didn't know that all that went into this. And then they usually ask, how long did it take for you to learn this? And I always say the same thing. I'll let you know. I'm still learning. You look at this collection of lines and circles on this flow graph. And for someone like me, it's like reading sheet music. I can look at that or the matrix and I can hear the music. I can see the comp. So I'll bring them into the process when I feel like they're already confident that I understand them and I'm solving their problems. I'm hearing them. I'm adding value to what I'm doing because I'm showing how complicated it is. Even if I'm freaking out and I have no idea internally how I'm going to solve this problem. I'll also sometimes tailor process to the specific ask. Like if I'm talking to a director or if I'm talking to a live action producer about what I would need in order to pull off a visual effect. I know that the director has a vision in mind and they don't want some schlub like me telling them, no, you can't move your camera. But I also know that the line producer is there knowing that everything that I ask for is another line item in their budget and it's going to cost them more money and take more time. First, get them on board with you. Bring them along, you know, make them know that you're their partner and you're there to solve their problems, make everything great. And then you can kind of show them how technical everything is.
I wanted to take a look at something that you said, which was problem solving. And sometimes how you go or, you know, the client will express something or you'll see something and you have no idea how to solve it. I'm assuming in your industry, you've had one or two very tight deadlines.
Today? Yeah. Yeah.
One or two today. How have you learned to problem solve quickly? Take me through, Andy, like how, you know, you're looking at the screen, you have no idea how something connects. What are things that bring you closer to that connection to solving that problem? And how have you sharpened your skills to a point where you're able to do it so quickly and efficiently?
Well, compositing, which is what we do, is really like the sum of its parts. Okay. So if I'm asked to do something, let's say I'm asked to do like some crazy cleanup or, you know, wire removal and I have no idea how I'm going to do this. I know in order to do this, I'm going to have to paint out the wire that crosses in front of my talent's face. And so I kind of break that down and I look at finding clean frames and then I'll borrow and beg from different parts of the image and I'll track those in and then I'll, you know, paint a little bit to clean up the edges. And the process of doing that relaxes me. Well, it does two things. Like it calms me down. It allows my mind to focus on this task right here. And then the other parts of my brain are kind of subconsciously are working on the other problems. Or maybe I now have clarity or something. And I'm not the part of my brain that's going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. You know, we're gonna die. This is fight or flight, is subdued. And at the end of that process, I've knocked one thing off the list. You know, I still don't know how I'm going to do step five, but step one is done. And then step two, and then step three. And that's usually how I get a technical thing solved. A creative problem, I had to do something the other day where they shot somebody on green screen jumping on a trampoline, and they wanted the trampoline to be replaced with a logo. And they were like, can the logo have like folds in it as though it's like really tight, taut fabric? The first place my mind went to was like, oh God, how am I going to do this? I don't have like a fabric simulator and I wouldn't know how to use it if I had one. I don't do that. But then I started thinking about it. Well, visually, what's a fold? It's just an area of shading that's different from what's around it. Or maybe the leading edge is bright and the trailing edge is dark. Well, okay. So I went and I painted real quick, like some lines, like an asterisk essentially. And then I use that asterisk to displace this graphic with just a straight up displacement map and softened it a bit and then added a light and moved it like behind the camera. And all of a sudden, guess what you got? Folds. And it's like, okay, that was how I solved this problem. By thinking about, well, what is a fold and not how am I going to simulate fabric? That isn't really the task at hand. As far as super creative things, I mean, I've never really built myself as somebody who's like, I'm not like a designer. I think I have an eye, but I'm not a designer. So I will definitely look before I just jump right in and try to figure out, you know, how to make a sunset or something like that. You know, the universe has figured that out. Why don't I look for some examples of that? And then as the good compositor that I am, I'll sample from it. There's gradients in nature. I'll find the gradients that I need.
Flow State will be back in just a minute. An incredible toolset is BorisFX's Sapphire. They let you create stunning organic looks unmatched by any host native effect tools. Key features include over 270 effects as well as 3,000 presets, including a powerful effect and transition builder, integrated tracking and masking with the award-winning Mocha. Sapphire's superior image quality control and render speed offers massive time savings, allowing creatives to focus on what matters most, delivering an impact that keeps audiences coming back. And now, back to the show.
I drew some parallels there to my own processes. One was on days where I feel very anxious about my never-ending to-do list that might be 100 items, where my brain is in panic mode, I'll sit down and then just write it down as a list and then use a technique where I take or pick the things that take 2 minutes to complete and I try to get them done. It reminds me of the step-by-step process you were talking about in The Flame, where you start to check things off and gain confidence like, okay, I can actually tackle some of this list today without becoming overwhelmed by it. And on a long-form project where there's 20,000 steps to get from point A to point Z, when you look at it as a whole, it's overwhelming. But if you break it down into segments or small chunks, it becomes a lot more easier to attain and to get to your final end destination. Speaking of creativity, you know, we've chatted about this. I always love to hear from artists. What does creativity mean to you?
Pure expression, like the expression of joy, sadness, happiness. For me, creativity is getting into that mode where I'm sitting down and just everything is firing on all cylinders. There's seamless connection between my brain and the Wacom pen that I have. And you can see the same thing in a jazz musician playing the piano, any musician playing the piano, or somebody painting, somebody surfing, skateboarding. It's just an unspoken vibe, I guess, you know, an energy. Yeah. And you feel like you could do nothing wrong. I love it. Sometimes I'll put music on. Sometimes there's just music in my head, which kind of freaks out the people who happen to be walking by. It's addictive being able to channel that energy within you. It's just, there's nothing like it. So for me, that's creativity.
So speaking of that energy, that flow state, like, do you take steps to try to get into that state? Are there other things as well that help and assist you to get into that ultimate zone?
Oh, sure. I'll give you two different answers. One when I'm working alone and one when I'm working with a team of people. With remote work and I'm a freelancer now, I do a lot of work in this room here by myself. Typically, what I need to do is just clear my mind. Boom. That's the first step. And that could mean finishing whatever conversations that have nothing to do with work that I need to get out of the way. It could mean making the bed. It could mean saying hello to all three cats. Or it's not like there's like a specific set of rituals that I need to go through. But I need to make sure that there's nothing distracting me. And then I have a playlist. I have a friend of mine who cannot believe that I only have one playlist. Like I am that guy who has one playlist. I have a mixtape. It's this eclectic mix of songs. Every single song means something. Not that it's a cohesive story. I didn't sit down and go like, and now I will assemble the playlist of my life. No, like at some point you're driving or you hear a song and you're like, ah, oh, I got to put that in the rotation. I just get into it and I start tackling the things in front of me. It's great. So that's how I do this when I'm alone. If I'm working with a team of people, I, as much as I love working from home, I'm not going to in any way tell you that working from home is not comfortable. It's extraordinarily comfortable. It is isolating and it is a fraction of as fun as working with a team. And when I do get to like go on site and work with a group of people, it is the best thing in the world. And I am a huge, huge, huge proponent of that frame of mind that what you put into the universe, you get back. When I'm working with a group of people, I try to elevate everybody, whether it's say something funny or usually it's say something funny. I'm not gonna lie to you. But just be supportive and then share a success. Or I'm also the kind of person that will freely tell you that I'm really good at what I do, but I do not know everything. I will be the first one to ask everybody for help in trying to solve a problem. I love it. I love that energy of being in a room full of other creative people. And then when you're all firing on all cylinders, there is nothing like it. It's like being in live theater or like jamming with a band. You don't want it to end.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, when I think back on the pandemic and how that isolated people to work from home, the different energy that I feel when I go into in-person conferences and get to chat with people at these events, like it's something that cannot be replicated. As hard as you might try on something like Zoom or face-to-face interaction with other creatives, it's incredible. And while there are, of course, benefits for working from home, I'm definitely a fan of the hybrid situation. A little bit of both, I think, goes a long way.
Yeah, I'm going to qualify that a bit. I am very, very, very glad that this whole work from home thing happened at this point in my career. My first Flame gig was at a place with 5 artists, and I cannot imagine a better learning environment. The constant thrill of trying to like figure things out together and problem solve together and work with other people and learn when to shut up and learn to know when you don't know everything and when you're wrong, and to have a group of people to support you and pick you up when you ultimately fall on your face, which we all do, and it's totally fine. The only thing problem with failing is when you don't learn from it, because it's inevitable. I mean, I'm reaping the benefits of this work from home thing now, but I'm very glad that I in the late 20th century when I started this thing.
In the late 20th century, that's going to become a thing soon. Oh my gosh,
dude! I saw like on social media, someone was like, it was like a 20-year-old or something who was like showing. I went and they found their father's collection of audio tapes, the soundtrack to the movie Cocktail, which had like Tom Cruise in it. And so this kid went, at first I thought this was a collection of Tom Cruise music, but actually no, it's a collection of music from the late 20th century. And I was like, oh God. Like at first I was like, how could you? Wow, you're right. Credit where credit is due, kiddo.
Kokomo automatically went to my brain from that soundtrack. Like I got the cassette tape at home. Other story for another time. I wanted to talk about something you mentioned earlier, the crazy amount of tools that are available for VFX artists today. The thousands of different ways to go about doing things. The big conversation in the last couple of years about AI. Is having so many tools available to you a hindrance to the process in some ways? When you talk to younger artists or people starting out and trying to make decisions about what to use in their own process, how do you give them guidance towards that?
I'm sorry. All I can think about are the lyrics to Kokomo right now. Could you repeat that question again? No, I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. I'm totally kidding. I got you. I've worked with a lot of young artists over the years, and there's always a few of them who are like, I want to learn Flame. And like, okay. And then after a week, they go, and now I want to learn After Effects. All right. And then after a week, they're like, I really want to learn Maya. Okay. Learn one thing and then move on. When I have to learn a new piece of software, okay, like I learned Nuke. I jumped into it and I was like, well, here's a gray screen. Like, okay, I know gray screens. I don't know where the paint button is in here, but I guarantee you I can paint. I guarantee you I can make a shape. I may not know the most efficient way to do it. That's always been my analogy for people and the amount of tools that are out there. Pick one thing and learn it. Learn it well. If you want to start out in the Adobe world, learn Premiere. Learn a timeline and then dive into segments on that timeline with After Effects. You know, learn a tool, learn it. We all know people who have to have every power tool in their garage. They need all 500 lenses or something that are available for a camera. And it's like, do you really know how to use all of them? And some do. Don't fall into that trap of like, you know, collecting tools. Learn one, learn it well.
When I started my career, I was putting together branding activation videos. So someone would go and shoot footage, and I would then cut it in Final Cut 3 at the time. I didn't know it at all. I was actually just pressing buttons and reading a manual to try to figure things out for when I needed it. And then at one point, this is like a year and a half later, I became so frustrated by my own process. I grabbed a book and I started reading it over and over and over again. I think it was 3 or 4 times where I knew every little component about how that software worked, and everything just clicked. Using the foundational background of this one piece of software has allowed me, just like you, to hop into other software and applications and be able to see similarities in interfaces and just understand how to get to places a bit quicker if need be.
Just also one little addendum there is knowing a tool. The definition for me of knowing a tool means knowing what to do when something isn't working. I can tell you here, we're going to name drop Boris Effects products here. So when I started to learn like Mocha, for example, like I had always done my Roto in Flame. Always since the beginning of my career. And then I started learning Mocha and everything was great until a track drifted or something like that. And for the record, tracks never drift in Mocha. It's an amazing tool. No, but something gets occluded, whatever. Like I know how to solve those problems in the tool that I know. I don't know how to solve those problems in the tool I don't know. And you don't really know how to get the most out of it until you know what to do when it doesn't just work. When you've reached that level with a tool, move on to the next tool. But you'd asked about AI, which I've heard of. The kids are talking about it now. It's all the rage.
The kids are talking about it. One is generative AI, and everyone was talking a little bit about OpenAI Sora and seeing some of the video creations, the end results of video that came out of that. I'm trying to remember the name, but there's also this like recent VFX tool that it's available through a web browser, but the idea is that you give it a character, a 3D character, and it will automatically T-pose it and then rig it for you with motion based on real life action footage. I was curious, have you seen tools being used in VFX, like specifically AI or generative AI, and that being helpful towards the process, or is it just not there yet?
Boy, here's a subject that's going to date itself real quick. Whatever answer I give is going to be obsolete by the time this airs, probably, just because of how quickly these tools evolve. Personally, I'm not afraid of any of this stuff at all. And maybe it's because I'm fortunate enough to do what I do at the level that I do it at, and I've been doing it for this amount of time. I'm not like oblivious to that reality. I use generative image AI. I can't paint. I mean, I can retouch. I can clean up. But if you ask me to like paint a sky, I can't paint a sky. I can't paint trees. I use Midjourney a lot. And what I'll do is I'll use it to create an element that I will then go and modify as I need. When I'm dealing with the clients that I deal with, Andy, we need to do a sky replacement. They want to see 5 different skies. Well, that used to require a stock search. And sometimes it still does. But what this allows me to do is quickly iterate elements. Maybe there are elements as part of that I'm going to use as part of like a matte painting or a set extension or something like that. And that's been so helpful, especially working as an independent artist. I don't have a CG department at my disposal like I did at my last staff job. I took a look at the renders from Sora. They're amazing. Like, I'm not going to tell you that they're not amazing. They're amazing. I mean, they're absolutely amazing. And I know that these problems are going to get worked out. But so far, generative AI is still, there's a lot of black box, man. There's a lot of like dark magic going on in there. What I've seen come out of some of these Sora videos are like, oh my God, here's a photorealistic video of a dog walking on the beach. You know, it's got like an astronaut on its head and there's confetti everywhere. In my world, that's useless unless I can respond to my client's feedback. The sand on the beach is just, it's got to be like grainier. Could there be a few seashells in there? These are the things that come up as part of like our creative process, especially in commercial post. Until we have that level of nuance, which you really only get in like full up CG, then I definitely see it as a tool. It's going to be used for a lot of low-hanging fruit, a lot of social media content that doesn't require that level of, where it's quantity over quality, I guess. It's going to be the best looking quantity over quality content you've ever seen. It may be free to you, or maybe $10 a month to you, but billions of dollars to get to that point. So I think until we solve some of those problems, it's a fascinating science experiment. I'm excited to see where it goes.
I love what you mentioned about your workflow there with Midjourney, using small components from it and integrating that into shots and into your work. I've done that a few times. I've created really abstract imagery and just be able to feed that into a layer in grunge within Boris Effects Continuum, infinite zoom in terms of sapphire. Some really interesting use cases there. And so just moving away from AI for a second, Andy, it's come to the time in the podcast where I'm going to ask you a series of just quick, rapid questions. The idea is to wrap these questions up in less than a minute. Can you give me 2 songs on your playlist?
Wow. Hold on. Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues and Money Talks by AC/DC.
Favorite TV show or movie that you saw this year?
Wow. TV shows I saw this year? Picard season 3. Oh man, I didn't want that show to end. I literally waited like over a week to watch the last episode because those were all my friends that I grew up with. And I got to be on a journey with them for 30 plus years.
I got to check it out. I haven't even seen Picard season 1. if someone had only 24 hours in New York, what one place would you say that they have to check out before going? That's not typical.
That was the other part.
Katz's Delicatessen. Get a pastrami on rye.
I love it. And my last question for you, what is something that most people don't know about you?
I'm sometimes plagued by insecurity. When I was a kid, like in high school, I'd have no idea what made me do this, but I started doing theater. And I was a really insecure kid. I was really concerned that everybody was judging me. I guess I was more obsessed with what are people thinking about me? Oh my God, what are they thinking about me? And I learned at a really young age, when most people were terrified of the spotlight, that when you're in the spotlight, you have the opportunity to control the audience, think whatever you want them to think. And so when I got into this job of being a visual effects artist, or being a flame artist, especially at a time when you had to like run a room, it's very easy for me to fall into the oh my God, what are they thinking about me? You know, what people don't know is when we started this podcast, I didn't know that any of the video was going to be used. And I was like, oh my God, I have my glasses on and my hair looks terrible. Can we push pause, Nick, so I can go put context? Like, I think about these things, but I also realize my basic instinct is to be insecure. And my way to overcome that insecurity is to step into the spotlight and just own the situation. That's it. You can hide from it, or you can take it, grab it by the horns, and bend it to your will. Maybe that's some advice for either a younger person or someone who's been doing this for a while. You have a tremendous amount of control over your day, your life, your destiny. You just have to be willing to take that control and just keep those voices at bay. They're always there.
That was really powerful. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for sharing that. I just reflected a little bit on my own childhood and thinking about personas of acting. So I really resonated with that and had an aha moment. And then I had just one final question for you before we part ways here in this podcast. And that is, 50 is a very monumental birthday. What goals do you have creatively for yourself moving forward?
You mean beyond making it to 51? For me, honestly, it's just never stop learning. I watched a lot of artists as I was coming up in this business stop. Like, they get complacent or they get safe. They're like, this is my territory and I'm holding on to it. Maybe subconsciously realized that I didn't want to be that person. And so I don't have a specific goal. I don't want to tell you that, like, well, by, 2027, I want to know Houdini or something like that. I love the journey. I love chasing the unanswered question or trying to solve a problem that, ooh, how am I going to do that? And so my goal creatively is just to keep pushing myself forward and just to continue having fun. It's the best job in the world.
I think that's quite beautiful, man. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I also just wanted to thank you for your time and sharing a little bit about your process and how you think, how you go about your VFX workflows and compositing. It's been really insightful for me, and I think for everyone who's going to be listening here. Hopefully, Only Kokomo will run in your head just for a little bit of time.
As you watch Zaruba, Jamaica.
Ooh, I want to take you.
Got you singing. Thanks, buddy.